Chapter 2. The Old Order and the New. A typical characterization of China's past, often put forward by Chinese modernizers in the 20th century, is that late imperial China was a corrupt, feudal mess that was held back by unchanging, conservative, Confucian thought. Yet the imperial Chinese state, while underpinned by ideas of order and hierarchy, was also driven by a sense of mutual obligation between different groups in society and gave rise to an ever-changing and highly dynamic political and social culture, although this had collapsed in many important respects by the early 20th century. However, Western political influence did change China profoundly in the late 19th century in the wake of the Opium Wars, when concepts such as nationalism and social Darwinism became hugely influential on a generation of Chinese who felt that their country was now vulnerable to the outside world. Japan also became a conduit for importing the new modern modes of thought. In 1868, the revolution known as the Meiji Restoration began, turning Japan in just a couple of decades from a feudal state run by a warrior aristocracy to a modernizing industrial empire. Among these modern political concepts that energized debate in the very last days of the Qing dynasty were the ideas of a constitution, parliamentary government, citizenship rather than subjecthood, and reorientation of China into an international system of nation-states. Even though the dynasty itself fell, these concepts would shape all political discussion in the 20th century and are indeed profoundly important today. The early 20th century was a time of great political distress in China, but also opened up unimagined new vistas for generations of Chinese at all levels of society. Rural girls who became factory workers, farmers who became communist activists, and middle-class students who learned about Japan, Europe, and America at first hand. The imperial system collapsed in the revolution of 1911, and in its place a republic was established. The political atmosphere of the time allowed fierce debates on nationalism, socialism, and feminism, among other ideas, although the Confucian influences and preconceptions still continued to shape everyday life. Civil war and the dominance of imperialist powers in China, however, prevented participatory politics from taking hold, even after the Northern Expedition of 1926-8, which brought the nationalists to power under Chiang Kai-shek, the successor to the veteran nationalist leader Sun Jiaxu. This chapter charts the first stage of that long journey towards a modern mass politics. The Age of Gold. The English Civil War and the American and French Revolutions had a profound influence on the relationship between Western governments and their people. The modernity of those systems lies in certain assumptions, that government should be representative of the people, and that the people have inherent rights to the choice and policies of their government, that government should act rationally and to the greatest benefit of all, and that citizenship, membership in a national body, should be granted on the basis of equality and not assigned by a hierarchy derived from any irrational, arbitrary, or otherworldly source. It is often assumed that non-European societies, such as China, shared few, if any, of these assumptions. Certainly some of them ran counter to Confucian norms, yet, as we shall see, the question of how the people might be governed justly was critical to many Chinese political discussions. Central to the assumptions of emperors and their officials were Confucian ideas about the makeup of the state. In these ideas, hierarchy was not only present, but essential. The body politic was held to be a metaphorical extension of the family. Just as sons should obey fathers and wives should obey husbands, so subjects should obey their rulers. The people did not have inherent rights as individuals or even as a collective body. However, it would be wrong to think that this made Chinese governance arbitrary, irrational, or despotic. A good ruler in the Confucian world was not at liberty simply to do as he pleased. The people were in his charge, and cruel or unfair behavior towards them would result in his losing the mandate of heaven. Confucius and philosophers who had followed in his tradition, such as Mencius, stressed that attendance to the welfare of the people was a primary task for any ruler. The great dynasties of imperial China certainly paid attention to questions of welfare, for example, removing tax burdens on areas where flooding had destroyed crops, and on occasion trying, not very successfully, to maintain ever-full granaries that would hold food reserves for distribution in times of hardship. Government was primarily concerned with the maintenance of order, but to do so, it was clear that the people had to feel that laws were applied fairly and equitably. At times of turmoil, the system became corrupt and dysfunctional, but during its periods of confidence and prosperity, such as the 18th century, the system was one of the world's most successful empires. Chen Hongmo was one of the most prominent administrators and thinkers on statecraft of the Haiqing, the period during the 18th century when China seemed peaceful and prosperous, a prime example of a well-run empire that looked to the good of its people. The assumptions and contradictions in Chen's writings show clearly the way in which Confucian principle and the realities of governance created an effective, though not always consistent, style of government. And in those contradictions, no great difference from the compromises of Western governments. Simultaneously, Qin and his contemporaries in the Qing bureaucracy showed a commitment to the traditional Chinese patriarchy, yet Qin also declared that heavenly goodness, Qianliang, lay in all people, even petty commoners, lowly yamen, local magistrates' office clerks, and even those who were not ethnically Han Chinese. Chen and his contemporaries also put into place policies that encouraged social mobility and popular education, including literacy for women, as well as merchant enterprises. None of the latter are popularly associated with Confucian thought, yet Chen advocated them with no sense of violation of the norms for a decent and well-ordered society. Wei Yuan, one of the most well-known thinkers of the late Qing era, thought broadly about the nature of political participation. He was a Qing loyalist, but strongly argued that the dynasty needed to reform its administration if it were to cope with the threat from overseas. While he never came anywhere close to advocating that the ordinary population of China should take part in their own governance, he wrote extensively about the danger of political sterility that could come from restricting both the numbers and scope for argument of those who could critique power holders. There is no single doctrine which is absolutely correct, and no single person who is absolutely good. Wei argued for a competition in ideas that would enable the ruler to choose between rival proposals, and in 1826 made his own contribution to that discussion by publishing the Collected Essays on Statecraft. Wei Yuan, however, did not want to widen political participation so as to reduce the role of the state, but rather to strengthen it. The New World. If the 18th century was a broadly successful one for China, the 19th saw the Qing dynasty disintegrate under a series of crises both internal and external. The most obvious trigger for collapse was the arrival of the Western imperial powers, demanding that China open itself up to their trading demands. But the Western impact alone was not enough to bring down the Qing. The grave internal stresses and strains manifested themselves in the seemingly separate effects of Western imperialism, with both sets of crises feeding off one another. Internally, the rapid expansion of the size of the Qing Empire had led to problems, as the bureaucracy did not increase to match its new responsibilities. Tax collection became more difficult and increasingly corrupt. Between 1600 and 1800, the size of the population doubled to some 350 million. The number of people who were poor and dissatisfied increased also. Regardless of the Western intrusion into China, one can see, in the late Qing, the signs of imperial overstretch that had also eventually doomed China's previous dynasties. Nonetheless, the arrival of European imperialism had effects that had simply not been relevant for the earlier dynasties. The development of the East India Company by the British meant that large quantities of opium being produced in Bengal now needed a market. The Chinese government, after some debate, banned the sale of opium within China, alarmed at its popularity and addictiveness. The British government, newly concerned with empire in Asia, took the ban and the destruction of British-owned opium in Canton Harbour as a provocation. The First Opium War of 1839-42 saw the Qing government defeated and forced to concede what would be one of a long list of treaties with foreigners made under duress and remembered by generations of Chinese as unequal. Between the mid-19th and the mid-20th centuries, Chinese governments were never wholly in control of their own territory. Foreigners, under treaty rights, had extraterritoriality, that is, they were not subject to Chinese law. A whole series of treaty ports were established in which foreigners had new trading rights, and some places, such as Hong Kong, were fully colonized, and new and disruptive influences, notably Christian missionaries, had to be allowed into China's exterior for the first time. The Qing rulers, overall, remained hostile to the foreign presence within China, trying to minimize it as much as their new, weaker status allowed. Within China itself, the ordinary population showed little enthusiasm for the arrival of foreigners in their midst, regardless of whether they were bringing guns or Bibles with them. The foreign presence often had unexpected results. One of the most notable was the Taiping War of 1851-64. Influenced by missionaries, a delusional failed examination candidate named Hong Shouqian from Guangdong announced that he was the younger brother of Jesus and that he had come to lead a Christian mission to end the rule of the Manchu devils of the Qing dynasty. Recruiting in China's impoverished south, his Society of God Worshippers quickly attracted tens of thousands of followers. Hong declared that he was establishing the Taiping Changguo, the heavenly state of great peace, and his army swept through China. By the early 1860s, the Taiping was effectively a separate state within Qing territory, with its capital at Nanjing, in charge of much of China's cultural heartland. The regime was ostensibly Christian, but its interpretation demanded the recognition of Hong's semi-divine status, and Taiping rule was harsh and coercive. However, the regime did manage the remarkable feat of conquering a huge area of central China for nearly 8 years. For a while, it looked as if the Taiping might bring the Qing crashing down. Certainly Karl Marx had hopes of this, and of aftershocks even further afield, writing in a New York newspaper in 1853, "The Chinese Revolution will throw the spark into the overloaded mine of the present industrial system and cause the explosion of the long-prepared general crisis." Eventually, the retraining of local armies by loyal generals such as Zhong Guofan, as well as the stresses within the Taiping movement itself, brought the rebellion to an end, although not before countless people had died in what was perhaps the bloodiest civil war in history. Contemporary accounts suggest that 100,000 people died in the final Battle of Nanjing alone. The following decades did see the Qing make efforts to reform its practices, and the self-strengthening movement of the 1860s involved notable attempts to produce armaments and military technology along Western lines. Yet imperialist incursions continued, and the attempts at self-strengthening were dealt a brutal blow during the Sino-Japanese War of 1894-5. Fought between China and Japan, the latter was now a fledgling imperial power in its own right, over control of Korea, it ended with the humiliating destruction of the new Qing Navy and the loss not only of Chinese influence in Korea, but also the cessation of Taiwan to Japan as its first formal colony. Most general histories, not least those written in China itself, have been highly dismissive of the last decades of Qing rule, regarding it as a period when a corrupt dynasty that refused to adapt to a new and hostile world was finally overthrown. For years, Marxist Chinese historians viewed the period as feudal and argued that its overthrow set the stage for a new, modern era that would eventually usher in the rule of the CCP. For this reason, it was essential to portray everything in China before Mao came to power as feudal or, in some sense, a failed modernity. However, it is now clear that significant steps towards modernity were taken in the late Qing. One reason was that there was a powerful Asian example of how reform might be carried out, Japan. The island country across the sea would remain in Chinese minds as both dangerous menace and modern mentor for decades, just as it looms large in Chinese minds in the contemporary era. The events that had inspired and concerned the Chinese had followed the Meiji Restoration of 1868. A group of Japanese aristocrats, worried by ever greater foreign encroachment on Japan, had overthrown the centuries-old system of the shogun, who acted as regent for the emperor. Instead, they restored the emperor to the throne under a new reign title of Meiji, brilliant rule, and governed in his name. These aristocrats swiftly determined that the only way to protect Japan was to embrace an all-out program of modernization. They showed little of the ambiguity that conservatives in the Qing court had done. In quick succession, Japan replaced its culture of elite samurai warriors with a conscripted citizen army. The country was given a constitution that established it as a nation-state, and a parliamentary system was set up, although with a heavily limited male-only franchise. Modernization did not mean abandonment of Japan's past, however. The traditional folk religion of Shinto was reconstituted as state Shinto, a more formalized religion that would give spiritual sustenance to the nation. Meiji Japan also intervened heavily in the economy. The end results were clear. By the first decade of the 20th century, Japan was a growing economic and imperial power which was even able to defeat a Western power, Russia, in the war of 1904-5. These headily swift changes in a country which the Chinese had always regarded as a little brother gave Chinese reformers plenty of material for consideration. One of the boldest proposals for reform, which drew heavily on the Japanese model, was the program put forward in 1898 by reformers including the political thinker Kung Youwei. Kung was driven by the conviction that the previous vision of Chinese modernity, based on self-strengthening, had failed because it had not been comprehensive enough in its aims. Kung illustrated to the emperor the need for more thorough reform by putting forward two contrasting case studies: Japan, which had reformed successfully, and Poland, a state which had failed so comprehensively that it had disappeared from the map, carved up by powerful neighbours in 1795. The reforms were not just led from the top. Among the phenomena that emerged from that period of change were a greater participation by lower-level Chinese elites in the demand for popular rights, a new flourishing of political newspapers, and the establishment of Peking University, which remains to this day the most prestigious educational institution in China. The reformers also strongly advocated changes in the position of women. However, in September 1898, the reforms were abruptly halted as the Dowager Empress Su Qi, fearful of a coup, placed the emperor under house arrest and executed several of the leading advocates of change. 2 years later, Su Qi made a decision that helped to seal the Qing's fate. In 1900, North China was rife with rumors of spirit possession and superhuman powers exercised by a mysterious group of peasant rebels known as Boxers. Unlike the Taiping, the Boxers were not opposed to the dynasty. Rather, they wanted to expel the influences that they believed were destroying China from within, the foreigners and Chinese Christian converts. In summer 1900, China was convulsed by Boxer attacks on these groups. Fatefully, the dynasty declared in June that they supported the Boxers, relabeling them as righteous people. Eventually, a multinational foreign army forced its way into China and defeated the uprising. The imperial powers then demanded compensation from the Qing, the execution of officials involved with the Boxers, and a sum of 450 million taels, $333 million, to be repaid over 39 years. The Boxer Uprising marked the last time, until Mao's victory, that a Chinese government made a serious attempt to expel foreigners from China's territory. Unlike Mao, half a century later, the Qing failed. That failure, and the huge financial burden and political disgrace which it had brought upon the dynasty, led to the most single-minded attempt at modernization that the Qing had ventured. Yet another reinterpretation of what modernity meant in a Chinese context. In 1902, the Xinjiang New Governance reforms were implemented. This was the new China of the 1910 book, with which the first chapter began. The reform was a remarkable and comprehensive set of changes to China's politics and society, which in many ways echoed the abortive 1898 reforms of just 4 years before. This set of reforms, now half forgotten in contemporary China, looks remarkably progressive, even set against the standards of the present day. In 1900-10, elections were proposed at the sub-provincial level to be held in 1912-14, with the promise of an elected National Assembly to come. The elections never happened because of the Republican Revolution of 1911, but it is possible now to look back and imagine an alternative world in which Qing China transformed into a constitutional monarchy, as indeed did happen in its southwestern neighbour Siam, Thailand, in 1932. The more immediate example to hand was Japan, and it is notable that many of the reforms of the period, such as in education, technology, and the police and military, were heavily shaped by Chinese who had learned from the Japanese example. The elections were limited, as were most such elections in the West at the time, to men, not women, of property and education, but the granting of such rights to any group showed how far society had changed in the last years of the Qing. Figures such as Zhang Jian, who set up factories in Nantong, a small city near Shanghai, were becoming typical of a new commercial middle class, and the dynasty actively encouraged the formation of bodies such as chambers of commerce to articulate the interests of such groups. The most significant cultural shift in the reforms came in 1905, with the abolition of the almost thousand-year-long tradition of examinations in the Confucian classics to enter the Chinese bureaucracy. When it had first been implemented, the objective, rational standards of the entrance examination, had made the system far more impressive than anything the rest of the world could offer in deciding who would govern. But by the early 20th century, the system had become inflexible, and the term eight-legged essay, referring to a standardized form of composition which the candidates had to write, had become synonymous with backwardness and conservatism to many reformers. In 1905, the dynasty replaced the system with alternative examinations in science and languages. So there were significant reforms during what turned out to be the last decade of Qing rule. Nonetheless, the dynasty did collapse, unlike the Japanese Empire of the time. Why, if the dynasty was not simply a corrupt shell and had real potential for reform, did it do so? First, the economic crisis of the late Qing was real, and in particular there was a problem with agricultural productivity. Historians trace its origins to the late 18th century, meaning that the foreign invasions exacerbated but did not create the crisis itself. In addition, the imposition of favorable tariff rates for the foreign powers meant that China's capacity to produce competitively in its domestic market or for export was hampered. Despite later arguments that the impact of imperialism actually helped China to develop, the British and French were clearly not investing in China to assist the Chinese economy, but rather to boost their own imperial projects. Japan, which swiftly renegotiated treaty rights that were over-favourable to foreigners, saw its much smaller economy grow much faster over the same period. In addition, the Qing made a particularly unwise choice in 1900 when it supported the Boxer Uprising. After the failure of the Boxers, the Qing dynasty was forced to pay an immense indemnity, a financial burden that led in part to the initiation of the Xinjiang reforms. Taxation revenue continued to be unreliable and marred by massive corruption in the late Qing. Second, ever since the Taiping, authority in China had become much more localized and militarized. The huge increase in the Chinese population during the Qing had made it ever harder for the bureaucracy to cope with administering society as a whole. Tax collection, the basis on which any society operates, had become insufficient and corrupt, with local officials adding surtaxes that lined their own pockets rather than going into the state's coffers. Silver shortages also led to inflation, causing further tax rebellions. Local elites had been instrumental in forming new armies from the 1860s that allowed the threat from the Taiping and other rebels to be beaten back. But this moved influence away from the central government and squarely towards the provinces. This would be a factor when the empire finally did collapse. The ground had been set for China to divide into feuding provinces led by warlords, each with his local army, something that would have been harder to imagine in 1800. Finally, it may have been the reforms themselves that doomed the dynasty. Empires often collapse when they try to reform and unleash a forum for voices that are hostile to those in authority. It was in 1989, during the most liberal era of communist rule, and not in 1969, at the height of the Cultural Revolution, that protesters filled Tiananmen Square demanding that the leadership step down. It was under the liberal Gorbachev, not the brutal Stalin, that the USSR finally collapsed. The abolition of the examinations in 1905, for instance, created a huge number of angry local elites. For centuries, men would spend years learning the Confucian classics in the hope that they might pass the increasingly severe level of examinations that would let them rise to local and even national status in the bureaucracy. Thousands of young and not-so-young men took these examinations, and very few passed. But now, the government abolished their raison d'etre at a stroke. From 1898 onwards, with the sudden ending of a promising series of reforms, too many of China's elites no longer trusted the Qing to reform China successfully. The Xinjiang reforms were not too little too late, but perhaps too much too late. Among the figures dedicated to ending rather than reforming the dynasty's rule was the Cantonese revolutionary Sun Yat-sen. Sun and his Revolutionary League made multiple attempts to undermine Qing rule in the late 19th century, raising sponsorship and support from a wide-ranging combination of diaspora Chinese, the newly emergent middle class, and traditional secret societies. In practice, his own attempts to end Qing rule were unsuccessful, But his reputation as a patriotic figure dedicated to a modern republic gained him high prestige among many of the emerging middle-class elites in China. As it turned out, however, his stock was less high among the military leaders who would have China's fate in their hands for much of the early 20th century. The end of the dynasty came suddenly and had nothing directly to do with Sun Yat-sen. Throughout China's southwest, popular feeling against the dynasty had been fueled by reports that railway rights in the region were being sold off to foreigners. A local uprising in the city of Wuhan in October 1911 was discovered early, leading the rebels to take over command in the city and hastily to declare independence from the Qing dynasty. Within a space of days, then weeks, most of China's provinces did the same thing. Provincial assemblies across China declared themselves in favour of a republic, with Sun Yat-sen, who was not even in China at the time, as their candidate for president. Yuan Shikai, leader of China's most powerful army, went to the Qing court to tell them that the game was up. On the 12th of February 1912, the last emperor, the 6-year-old Puyi, abdicated. The crisis of the republic. In 1912, the Republic of China was declared. In 1949, Mao Zedong announced the establishment of the People's Republic of China. The 37 years of the Republic, founded in 1912, were dismissed by the communists as a time of failure and broken promises, and in general, they continue to be regarded as a dark time in China's modern history. Certainly, there was much to condemn during the period. Poverty, corruption, and China's weakness in the international system. Yet, as in Weimar Germany, another period of political turmoil, the chaos actually cleared space for new ideas and a powerful cultural renaissance to begin. In terms of freedom of speech and cultural production, the Republic was a much richer time than any subsequent era in Chinese history. Even in political and economic terms, Chapter 5, the period demands serious reassessment. Yet one cannot deny that the high hopes that the revolutionaries had for their republic were swiftly dashed. Sun Yat-sen had returned to China from his trip abroad when the 1911 revolution broke out, and briefly served as president before having to make way for the militarist leader Yuan Shikai. In 1912, China held its first general election, and it was Sun's newly established nationalist, in Chinese Kuomintang, party, which emerged as the largest party. Parliamentary democracy did not last long. The nationalist prime minister in waiting, Song Jiaorun, was assassinated at Shanghai railway station, and shortly afterwards the nationalist party itself was outlawed by Yuan Shikai. Sun had to flee into exile in Japan, not to return until 1917, after Yuan had died. However, the death of Yuan and the lack of parliamentary representation meant that there was no unifying leader for China, and the country split into rival regions ruled by militarist leaders, warlords, from 1916 onwards. Whoever controlled Beijing was recognized by the international community as the official government of China and was also entitled to national tax revenues from the Maritime Customs Service, the unusually structured agency that brought in income for the national government. It was an institution of the Chinese state, but largely staffed and run at senior levels by Westerners. This meant that control of the capital was a financial as well as symbolic prize. Yet governments in Beijing in reality often controlled only parts of northern or eastern China and had no real claim to control over the rest of the country. The most notable challenge to the idea that the new Republic of China was an independent, sovereign and modern state was the reality that foreigners still had right of veto or control over much of China's domestic and international policy. The global situation following World War I had slowed down formal European imperial expansion, but Britain, France, the US, and the other Western powers showed little desire to lose those rights, such as extraterritoriality and tariff control, which they already had. Japan, unlike the Western powers, sought further expansion. In 1915, while Europe was distracted by war, the Tokyo government made the notorious 21 demands to the warlord government of the time, demanding and obtaining exclusive political and trading rights in large parts of China. To many Chinese, the weakness and venality of the Republic seemed a mockery of the whole project of modernizing China. The city of Shanghai became the focal point for the contradictions of Chinese modernity. By the early 20th century, Shanghai was a wonder, not just of China, but of the world, with skyscrapers, neon lights, women and men in outrageously new fashions, and a vibrant, commercially minded, take-no-prisoners atmosphere that made it famous or notorious as the pearl or the whore of the Orient. Its central areas, the International Settlement and French Concession, were out of Chinese governmental control, being run respectively by a Foreign Ratepayers Council, the Shanghai Municipal Council, and a French governor. This caused a conflict of feelings among many Chinese, from elite to grassroots level. The racism that came with imperialism could be seen every day, from the kicks and beatings given by boorish European travellers to rickshaw drivers, all the way up to the race bar that prevented rich, bourgeois Chinese from membership in European clubs or entry to certain public parks in the city. Yet the glamour of modernity was undeniable too. Millions of migrant workers streamed from the countryside to Shanghai to make a new life. More elite Chinese came to the city to encounter French fashion, British architecture, and American movies, and to enjoy the relative freedom of publication and speech that the city seemed to afford. It is no surprise that Shanghai, in the pre-war period, had more millionaires than anywhere else in China, yet also hosted the first Congress of the Chinese Communist Party. Overall, however, Chinese politics seemed to many to be collapsing into warlordism and regionalism by the 1920s. Yet the political situation was not all bleak, nor were the warlord armies simply the weak and ineffective soldiers they were often mocked as being by Western observers. Some militarist leaders lived up to the popular image, such as Zhang Zuolin of Manchuria, who was an illiterate, though shrewd and calculating, former bandit, who in 1923 spent 76% of his region's tax revenues on warfare to increase his territory, and only 3% on education. Others, however, were interested in construction as well as warfare. Yan Xishen of Shanxi became well known as one of the most progressive warlords, actively promoting an anti-foot-binding campaign in his province, and Zhang Zuolin's son, Zhang Zhuiliang, oversaw a significant increase in transport, education, and commercial infrastructure in Manchuria, the northeastern provinces of China. Nor, despite their reputation for corruption, were the militarist governments capable only of considering their own immediate interests. A case in point is China's entry into World War I. The militarist group that held power in Beijing in 1917 had calculated that the Great War in Europe would end with the defeat of Germany, one of the great European empires which held colonial rights on Chinese territory. Prime Minister Duan Qirui argued that it would help China's cause to support the war on the Allied side. Duan's government offered combat troops, which the French were willing to accept, as the number of French casualties climbed higher by the month. The British were less keen. They had lost proportionately fewer men and were more sensitive about racial hierarchy. In the end, 96,000 served on the Western Front, not as soldiers, but digging trenches and doing hard manual labour. Around 2,000 of them died in Europe. The Chinese government, despite its problems and its lack of popular mandate, had made a momentous decision. China could, and should, become involved in international conflicts. It was involvement in World War I, however, that led to one of the most important events in China's modern history, the student demonstrations on the 4th of May 1919. May 4th Movement. The news was bad. On the 30th of April, it became clear that the Paris Peace Conference was not going to return to Chinese sovereignty the parts of Shandong province that had been colonized by the now-defeated Germans. Instead, the Allied powers would hand them to Japan. Just 5 days later, on the 4th of May 1919, some 3,000 students gathered in central Beijing, in front of the Gate of Heavenly Peace, and then marched to the house of a Chinese government minister closely associated with Japan. Once there, they broke in and destroyed the house, and beat a visiting official so badly that his body was covered in marks that looked like fish scales on his skin. This event, over in a few hours, became a legend. Even now, any educated Chinese will understand what is meant by May 4th, no year necessary. For the student demonstration came to symbolize a much wider shift in Chinese society and politics. The new republic had been declared less than 8 years earlier, yet already the country seemed to be falling apart because of imperialist pressure from outside and warlord government within China that had destroyed its fragile parliamentary democracy. The May 4th movement, as it became known, was associated closely with the new culture, which intellectuals and radical thinkers proposed for China to be underpinned by the twin panaceas of Mr. Science and Mr. Democracy. In literature, a May 4th generation of authors wrote fiercely anti-Confucian works, condemning the old culture that they felt had brought China to its current crisis, and explored new issues of sexuality and individual selfhood. Chapter 6. In politics, young Chinese turned in desperation to new political solutions, among them the Nationalist Party of Sun Yat-sen and, for the more daring, the fledgling Chinese Communist Party, founded in 1921. Many of its founder members, including the young Mao Zedong, had been associated with the intellectual ferment at Peking University, whose students had been prominent in the May 4th demonstrations. In the decades since, the CCP has become the world's largest governing party and has long since become the establishment in Chinese politics. Yet it still regularly attributes its origins to the rebellious students who marched on the 4th of May 1919. Double dealing by the Western allies and Chinese politicians who had made secret deals with Japan led to an unwelcome discovery for the Chinese diplomats at the Paris Peace Conference. The former German colonies on Chinese soil would not be returned to Chinese sovereignty, but instead would be handed over to the Japanese, who had also entered the war on the Allied side in 1917. Patriotic demonstrations by students in Beijing on May 4th became symbolic of a wider feeling of national outrage that China was being weakened internally by its unstable militarist governments and externally by the continuing presence of foreign imperialism. The outrage symbolized by the May 4th demonstrations gave rise to a whole range of new thinking collectively termed the New Culture Movement, which stretched from around 1915 to the late 1920s. In China's cities, literary figures such as Lu Xun and Ding Ling wrote fiction that was designed to alert China to its state of crisis. Chapter 6. Political thinkers turned to a variety of isms, such as liberalism, socialism, and anarchism, and also sought inspiration in a variety of foreign examples, including nationalist figures such as Washington and Kossuth, but also non-European figures such as Gandhi and Ataturk. The shooting of striking factory workers in Shanghai by foreign-controlled police on the 30th of May 1925, the May 30th incident, inflamed nationalist passions yet further, giving hope to Sun Yat-sen's Nationalist Party, now regrouping under the protection of a friendly warlord in Canton. The ism which emerged at this time, and would later become dominant, was, of course, communism. The Chinese Communist Party, CCP, later the engineer of the world's largest peasant revolution, started with tiny urban roots. It was founded in the intellectual turmoil of the May 4th movement, and many of its founder figures were associated with Peking University, such as Chen Duxiu, Dean of Humanities, Li Dajiao, head librarian, and a young Mao Zedong, a mere library assistant. In its earliest days, the party was more like a discussion group of like-minded intellectuals with few members, although it was still politically dangerous to take part in its activities. Few of its members yet had a strongly theoretical view of Marxism. The process that would help turn the CCP into a machine to rule China would be stimulated by the intervention of Soviet assistance. Before that happened, the CCP would find itself in alliance with the nationalist leader Sun Yat-sen. The Northern Expedition. Sun himself did not return to China as a national leader in 1917. Instead, he was forced to rely on the support of a militarist leader in Guangdong province, Chen Zhongming, who was sympathetic to Sun's ultimate aim of reuniting China and allowed him a base in Canton. The other key source of support for Sun was international. Sun had tried in vain to gain Western and Japanese assistance, but in 1923 he was able to gain formal support from the world's newest and most radical state, Soviet Russia, later the USSR. The Soviets did not think that the fledgling CCP, which they advised from its foundation in 1921, had any realistic prospect of seizing power in the near future. Therefore, they ordered the party to ally itself with the much larger bourgeois party, the Nationalists. At the same time, their alliance was attractive to Sun. The Soviets would provide political training, military assistance, and finance. From the Canton base, the Nationalists and CCP trained together from 1923 in preparation for their mission to reunite China. Sun himself died of cancer in 1925. The succession battle in the party coincided with the sudden rise in anti-foreign feeling that came with the May 30th demonstrations and boycotts. Under Soviet advice, the Nationalists and CCP prepared for their big push north in 1926, the Northern Expedition that was supposed to finally free China from splits and exploitation. In 1926-7, the Soviet-trained National Revolutionary Army made its way slowly north, fighting, bribing, or persuading its opponents into accepting nationalist control. The most powerful military figure turned out to be an officer from Zhejiang named Chiang Kai-shek. Trained in Moscow, Chiang moved steadily forward and finally captured the Great Prize, Shanghai, in March 1927, Figure 3. However, there was a horrific surprise in store for his communist allies. Chiang's opportunity to observe the Soviet advisers close up had not impressed him. He was convinced, not without reason, that their intention was to take power in alliance with the Nationalists and then thrust the latter out of the way to seize control, Bolshevik style, on their own. Instead, Chiang struck first. Using local thugs and soldiers, Chiang organized a lightning strike that rounded up Communist Party activists and union leaders in Shanghai and killed thousands of them with immense brutality. Chiang's actions were part of a wider tapestry of violent conflict that rocked China throughout this period. In the south, where the CCP had the upper hand, there were massacres of nationalist supporters. The nationalist government of Chiang Kai-shek was born in blood, yet it deserves a more objective assessment than it has had until recently. In many ways, as Chapter 3 suggests, the nationalists under Chiang and the communists, eventually led by Mao, had much in common. Both parties saw themselves as revolutionary, and both would swiftly conclude that their revolutions had come grinding to a halt. The slogan of the Nationalist Party, "The revolution is not yet complete," could have been uttered with equal conviction by Mao. It was their similarity of intention, in part, that made their rivalry so deadly.